You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When you see a flower and it's blue, do you see the same blue flower that I do? Is your sensation of cold the same as mine? The mystery of human consciousness has been the subject of philosophical study for millennia, but today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the biology of consciousness and what brain science seems to be uncovering about who we are and how we experience the world around us. Joining us are Gerald Edelman, Nobel laureate, director of the Neurosciences Institute in La Jolla, California, and author of many books about the neurobiology of consciousness, including Wider Than the Sky, The Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness. Also, Christoph Koff, professor of biology and engineering at the California Institute of Technology in Southern California, and author of The Quest for Consciousness, A Neurobiological Approach. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Welcome, Leonard.
And Dr. Edelman, who you used to come on the show when you were here in New York on Rockefeller Institute. We really were saddened when you moved out to California. Glad to speak to you again. When did this neurobiological search for an understanding of consciousness begin?
Well, it began, I believe, early on, perhaps in the 50s, but then it sort of quieted down. And it's only in the last decade or so that interest has been very much focused, largely as a result of several people who are eminent in the field of neurobiology.
What about the development of new tools? MRIs and PET scans are getting more and more sophisticated, aren't they?
Yes. Without a question, one has to say that, as you indicated in your introductory remarks, that the subject belonged to philosophers for a long time. But the possibility of doing non-invasive scanning of the brain to figure out what's going on in terms of its activity in human beings has been a great advance. There's no doubt about that. And there are techniques involving, as you say, fMRI, but also electrical techniques and magnetic techniques, magnetoencephalography, ways of seeing what happens in the brain during particular tasks.
Blood flow, as well as when certain neurons just go on or off.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, although most of what we know about neurons is from animal studies. So there are really two sorts of studies. As Jerry pointed out, there's the imaging studies in humans, and then everything we know about the nerve cells and synapses that, by and large, comes from animal studies.
Now, Dr. Yes. Koff, in the world of science, is there agreement about how consciousness can be defined?
No. Oh, dear me. Christoph and I think, probably agree, although I think a blanket answer to that question would say not really. There are many distributed opinions about the subject.
Even though we are talking about something that is being dealt with on a scientific level, is it because we're still too early in all of this? Last night I was speaking with Oliver Sacks, and I asked him a question about something in his book, and he said, well, 2 months ago he would have given me one answer, but now he's not so sure. Do things move that quickly in neurobiology?
Well, yes. On the other hand, of course, the great virtue of scientific approaches is when you get the data, you still have to be very skeptical and be very sure you test it in very many ways. As Christoph has just indicated, for example, it is very difficult to be absolutely sure about the conscious state of certain animals as compared to human beings who can report. And so, in effect, there are differences of opinion, but it doesn't mean that the subject is not able to be discovered in terms of scientific description.
Well, Dr. Koff, how do tests on animals, what do they tell us about consciousness in humans?
Well, they tell us that the basic underlying hardware, the brain, is very similar. If you look at a dog, you know when the dog's in pain, it winces, it yelps, it vocalizes, it crawls under the table, it puts its tail between its legs, things very similar to what you would do. And you can give it the same drug, the same, you know, aspirin, and it'll help the dog with the pain just as it'll help you. So, and given the close evolutionary continuity between at least all mammals and us, it's very likely on the matter that all animals are conscious, including humans. Now, that's not to say that the consciousness of animals is the same as our consciousness, but the basic fact that they feel pain, they feel pleasure. We're all children of nature, and we all experience the sounds and fury of life.
And in fact, what Christoph has just said, Mr. Lopate, is supplemented by the fact that if you look at what parts of the brain seem to be critical for consciousness. We have those parts in dogs, for example, in a perfectly homologous way thanks to evolution. So, for example, one of the critical parts of the brain for consciousness as we know it is the cerebral cortex, which is that wrinkled structure you see in pictures of the brain, which have unfolded to be the size of a large table napkin and maybe as thick, and have 30 billion neurons and a million billion connections at least. So if you counted one connection per second, you just finished counting 32 million years later in a human being. And a dog isn't very far behind, perhaps because it doesn't have as much of a frontal cortex, as they say. But you need that organ, in a way, to carry out conscious behavior.
I understand there's a way of speaking about consciousness that divides the conversation according to the easy problem and the hard problem.
Yes.
Well, that's an attitude of some philosophers. That's not necessarily shared by all scientists.
Oh, so you would just... You don't share that.
Well, no, not quite. I mean, the belief that the belief is particularly by David Chalmers and philosophers like him, that's the easy problem. That's by and large what we scientists and doctors and clinicians address, which is, what are the neuronal mechanisms in your brain, in my brain, or in a dog's brain that give rise to various conscious feelings and why they're there.
That's hard enough.
The claim of these philosophers is that it's called the hard problem, that why matter? Why matter can be sentient? Why anything, your brain or even a computer could have these feelings, could have these subjective states, that is forever beyond a scientific theory.
Yeah, Ms. Lope, what we must do is go back to the philosopher René Descartes, who first said in his quest for certainty that he thinks, therefore he is, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And he put forth this idea that the world consisted of extended things which could be subject to science, and res cogitans, thinking things which could not. And of course, we believe as scientists that that doctrine is false, as great a philosopher as he was, that it simply doesn't hold up. Now, the hard problem is the problem of what philosophers call qualia, the warmness of warmth, the greenness of green, that kind of thing. But we have every evidence to indicate that those feelings are entailed by the kind of neurological and neural structures that we investigate in the laboratory and in those non-invasive techniques.
Now, Dr. Kopp, what are qualia? Is there agreement about what they are and how they express our experiences in a useful way?
No, I mean, as Jerry said, that's the heart of the mind-body problem. So qualia are the elements that make up your conscious sensation. For right now, you have a qualia for my voice. When Jerry talks, you have a qualia for his voice. When somebody steps on your toe while we're doing this interview, you have a qualia for pain. And the mystery is, the question is, how do qualia emerge out of, somebody rubs my brain, something happens in my brain, some electrical event happens in my brain, and then I have pain or pleasure or see something or feel sad. So how does that happen?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is to consider that consciousness itself is not a thing. It is a process. This was first pointed out by the great philosopher and psychologist William James at the turn of the last century.
Henry's brother.
Henry's brother, the very famous Henry's brother. And he was perhaps the greatest of thinkers in American history on this subject. And he said that consciousness is a form of awareness. And he made a big point about how it's being a process, not a thing. People often confuse that. And therefore, it can't be causal in the same sense as I hit a baseball with a bat. But it is, in fact, entailed by the causal processes of the nerves that work to indicate consciousness in the human brain. And that is not a complicated problem for scientists. For example, the blood protein hemoglobin, which is red, has its property entailed by its chemical structure. And I believe Christoph and I would agree that it is the structure of the neurons right down to the last detail that give you this ability to perceive, to feel, to have all of those qualia.
My guests are Gerald Edelman and Christoph Kopp, and we're talking about consciousness on today's Please Explain. For all of you who want to look up qualia, it's spelled Q-U-A-L-I-A. Christoph, I read an article recently which described a woman who was in a coma but who appeared to be having responses that would indicate what we would call consciousness reactions in her brain activity to descriptions of places and sensations that were familiar with her. So what does that say to you about what consciousness is?
Well, so this is a patient of Adrian Owen in England, and what it tells us that we can use brain imaging to communicate with these people who are otherwise we couldn't communicate with. So to all extent and purposes from the outside, this lady who had a car accident was called persistent vegetative state. And we couldn't doctors couldn't communicate with her. She couldn't move her eyes reliable or, you know, signal with her hand. But then if you ask her to imagine, for example, walking through a house, one room after the other, or to imagine playing tennis, then the same parts of the brain that light up when I ask you this question while you're in a magnetic scanner also lit up in her. So it tells us that there's a way to communicate with these people, and it tells us something about the brain region that are important for certain forms of consciousness.
Well, is consciousness located in a particular part of the brain, or is it the result of a more global neural phenomenon? Dr. Edelman, you've written a lot about Darwinism. Isn't that a theory that deals with this?
Well, let me deal with the first part of your question first. Christoph and I have had some discussion of this, along with the late Francis Crick. I do not believe, I don't know what Christoph's belief is at this moment, I do not believe there are specific consciousness neurons. However, there are neurons in special parts of the brain which are absolutely not only necessary, but perhaps in some degree sufficient for consciousness. One of these is the cortex. The other is a little organ called the thalamus, which projects to the cortex and contains ways of communicating both feelings and motor actions. And the fact is that, of course, there are parts of the brain that have nothing to do with consciousness. For example, if you remove the cerebellum, it would be very unlikely that you have any loss of consciousness per se. But the fact is, we have identified certainly this thalamocortical system as being critical, and I don't know what Christoph thinks at this moment, but I'd like to engage him on that.
No, I mean, I by and large agree with you. It has both global and local properties.
Yeah.
Local property in the sense that certain types of neurons and circuits are essential, and global properties in the sense the entire brain needs to be aroused. There needs to be a certain type of neural excitation throughout the brain, otherwise you are in coma. Otherwise you're like Terry Schiavo. You wouldn't be conscious at all. So both things are necessary.
But by the way, Mr. Lopate, the interesting thing is, in a certain sense, we all know what consciousness is. It's what you lose when you fall into a deep, dreamless sleep, what you regain when you wake up. But, of course, that's not sufficient for a scientific answer. And, of course, it's one of the most challenging, of most interesting of all problems of modern science.
Although when we fall into a deep sleep, we still can be aware of things that are happening.
Dreams.
Well, not just in our dreams, but you hear an alarm go off or a car horn or something, or you smell fire and there you are. The conscious part of your brain is right there and totally alert.
It's being woken up. So you're unconscious at that state. If you're you're really in the deep sleep phase, and then this alarm signal wakes up part of your brain that were always vigilant, but they're not conscious. They're vigilant. They're little zombie agents. They monitor, you know, your ears, and when the appropriate sound comes, like a mother and her baby cries, then she's awake, and then she becomes conscious.
Yeah, so we have to distinguish between two types of sleep. One is deep sleep, in which the brain waves are really rather repetitious and slow, and that's the state in which it's not very likely you're conscious. However, there's something called REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, in which you are in a form of consciousness. You have conscious of certain kinds of dreams without the constraint of reality, but of your memory. Instead, the brain speaking to itself.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And my guests are Gerald Edelman, Nobel laureate, director of the Neurosciences Institute in La Jolla, California, and Christoph Koff, who's professor of biology and engineering at the California Institute of Technology in Southern California. Stay with us. We're talking about consciousness on Please Explain Today with two men who have been called the titans in the field, Gerald Edelman and Christoph Koff. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, just one other thing. What are your thoughts about the people who have described the brain as a kind of a computer? Do you think it is?
Well, no. I have written extensively about this subject, and of course the problem, again, is one of definition. A computer was defined by the great English mathematician Alan Turing as a device which is called a Turing machine. And that is a very specific kind of mathematical theorem, which applies to his specific construction. And what he showed was, as long as you had effective and unambiguous procedures, or what scientists call algorithms, he could construct a mathematical representation of any computer possible. But when you look very carefully, you have to understand that the brain is embodied inside of your body, which influences the brain, and the body and brain are embedded in the environment. But the environment is not a piece of tape. It's not unambiguous. The possible choices are myriad, and therefore the entire ensemble of interactions is not a Turing machine. Furthermore, when you look at the way the brain develops, every single brain is unique. The fact is that neurons that fire together wire together after a certain period of making a brain, and that means that every individual's experience is already embedded in the microstructure of the brain, the very fine structure. So in all these respects, and in the same respect that the brain can deal with ambiguous situations, it's very likely the brain is not a computer, digital or otherwise.
And I'm sure you agree, Dr. Kopp.
I'm not sure. Christoph?
Well, we don't know. I agree, it's certainly not a digital computer. It's hardware, and the way it does things is very different from, you know, the computer on your desktop. But we don't know whether it can be simulated completely by a computer. We just don't know right now.
My problem is getting everything into the hard drive, but that's another matter. Let's take some calls. Our number 212-433-9692. Heather from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm a neuropsychologist. I work at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. I'm interested in the neural basis of consciousness. And I'm wondering, if we discover the precise neural correlates of consciousness, what does that say about free will?
Oh, dear. May I defer to Christoph on that subject?
Well, Heather, what does this tell us about the nature of consciousness, of free will? Well, I mean, that's... So there are two aspects to the free will problem. One is, are we truly metaphysical free in the sense of that René Descartes meant, or in the libertarian sense, in other words, that I'm free to do anything I want, or does my brain determine what I do and then the conscious me catches up? And as you probably know, there's a famous experiment by a gentleman called Ben Libet, who died this year, who showed that at least in simple laboratory setting, when you think you freely, consciously decided to do something, your brain already decided 1 second before. So it seems to tell us that free will may be an illusion, may be a chimera.
Now there we go, Christoph. Here's the situation. From a scientific point of view, if you assume that there was absolute free will, then you'd have to get rid of a lot of laws of physics because the brain is determined, however complex it is, by the laws of physics. So in a certain way, we are determined to have it. That is to say, we have to treat each other as if we have it, socially speaking, but in deep fact, at the level of the brain, it is a form of conscious illusion.
Does that help, Heather?
Oh, it's kind of, it helps, but it's sort of... what does it say in terms of personal responsibility if somebody commits a crime? What does
Let me try.
Well, I mean, there's this wonderful joke when a criminal comes up to a judge and the criminal says, "Well, judge, you know, I did this horrible thing, but it wasn't me, it was my brain, and here I show my MRI, there's a hole in the location where other people have the sense of moral responsibility, and that's why I committed the crime." And the judge says, "Well, that's fine, and I don't think you're not a guilty, you're not an evil man. However, I'll lock up your brain for 10 years." So we still treat, what the joke tells us, that we still treat people as autonomous agents.
That's
we
it.
We lock them up when they did things that we as a society disapprove of.
Or
were they really responsible in sort of this libertarian sense? That's a question for theologians and philosophers.
Yes, exactly. We must, in fact, consider that we are determined to have it in both senses of the word. It determines us, but we are determined to treat each other as if we have free will and therefore responsibility. So, in effect, it's a very curious situation. It's one of the great unsolved problems that philosophers argue about all the time. But I think in one way, one can look at it this way, that the complexity of the brain still is determined by scientific and physical laws. But in fact, just consider this, Heather. Supposing you had free will, how would you act differently?
How would you act differently, Heather?
That's a very good question. Well, I'm under the illusion that I have it, so I guess
good.
I act the same way that I would act right now.
It is not a destructive thing.
Well, but
you know, we
I mean, interject. There's probably a functional reason why we do have this. If it is an illusion, why we do have this illusion. It helps us. It enables us to do things because we believe we can actually make a difference.
Exactly.
If you talk to Alcoholics Anonymous people, right, they're constantly being told only you can make a difference. Only you can stop drinking. You have to want it. If you tell them, well, I'm sorry, it's not really you. It's really your brain. And if your brain decides to stop drinking, then you'll stop drinking, right? Obviously, this has never worked. So the belief in free will has a power, has a causal power and can move mountains.
But you mentioned alcohol. One of the ways that we treat people who have problems with these kinds of things and making decisions is psychotropic drugs. What does their impact tell us about brain function and experience?
Well, I mean, in general, it tells us the brain is a physical system, and if you put various chemicals in, we're going to be affected in predictable, known manners. So it's, in general, in specific, it may tell us certain neurotransmitters that are more important. For example, you know, there's some neurotransmitters that are more important for consciousness and others that are less. So you have to talk about specific drugs.
Yeah, in fact, you have to say what specific details you're applying the drugs to. The main thing is this. We don't fully understand yet, even though there have been many scientific studies, exactly all of the details of how some of these drugs work. But empirically, certainly, they do work, and they do constrain the state of the brain and change it to some degree for effective reasons. And therefore, they're useful, but of course, they mustn't be abused either.
My guests are Dr. Gerald Edelman and Dr. Christoph Koff, and we're talking about consciousness on today's Please Explain. And Jerry from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Oh, by the way, can I tell everyone, because I have free will, that this is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast. I'm Leonard Lopate. Yes, Jerry.
Yes. Question has to do with the discovery of mirror neurons and the idea that not only can we become conscious of ourselves and our own processes, but that we can also, either through empathy or through some kind of signaling back and forth in a nonverbal way, that we can actually become conscious of what somebody else may be conscious of, on at least on some level.
Yeah, indirect. We can infer. Yeah, these neurons that have now also been found in humans by neurosurgical experiments enable us to infer what other people may be conscious of, that another person may be in pain or maybe in love.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in fact, the first discovery was made by having a person imitate a monkey reaching for, say, a nut. And while you were recording from the brain, particularly in certain motor and anterior parts of the brain, and what they found out is that these nerve cells fired as long as the person imitated the act. But if, in fact, he tried to lift up the nut with, a pliers, then they didn't fire. So they're sort of a basis for replicating or imitating a particular action. And since then, it's been extended considerably. It's a quite important discovery.
Which is now being applied to autism and other things because there is a feeling that the mirror neurons don't work the same in cases like autism.
Yes. Well, I mean, what's important to add to what Jerry said, that this was discovered again in animals, in macaque monkeys. So there's, once again, this evolutionary continuity. It's something that not only we have, but also little closely related species such as monkeys and presumably great apes as well.
Well, let's go to Dylan from the East Village. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering about what you think of the late Princeton scientist Julian Jaynes in his work.
The origin of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Bicameral mind, yes.
Very beautiful Britain, pure fantasy. So
let me say that it has high prose style, but not much connection with the facts.
No, nothing.
Well, why is that? Do you think that it was satisfying certain ideas, certain needs that readers might have?
Perhaps we should say what he said. What he said was that, for example, Greek heroes, the Homeric heroes, had a part of their brain, the right brain, which was speaking in a voice of the gods and telling them what to do. By the way, it relates to the free will problem. And that's the bicameral, the two-chambered mind. The problem is that there's a great confusion here about what language means, what meaning means, and what nerve cells actually do. And so it was one of those hypotheses, which there are many, in which you postulate what consciousness is without any reference to the hard facts. No brain, no consciousness. But your brain, of course, can make up a fantasy.
Let's go to another call. Charlie from Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and joining the conversation here. A question or a comment. I notice frequently that people who discuss issues of neurobiology in particular tend to make certain metaphysical claims, I guess, by using the word is or to be. These two gentlemen, I think, are actually being pretty clean about it, but I wonder if they comment. It seems to me that if you say, I raise my arm to lift a glass of water, you can also describe that in terms of a series of neurons firing. You can also describe it as a toast. You can describe all kinds of phenomena using many terms of reference. Chemistry is only one of them. Theology is another. Literature is another.
Yes.
Poetry is another. Sure. And sometimes I think we're a little uncareful. We tend to fall into things like saying, well, we don't have enough science yet to say what it really is. I suggest to you that's misleading. I should confess I'm a recovering philosopher. Would they comment
maybe,
on that?
Are you excuse me, can I ask you whether you're resentful as a philosopher that science has taken over the whole discussion of consciousness?
No, not resentful. I just I think there's room for both. Neither one has any claim of superiority. To me, the only question is which is more useful. For example, when you talk about creating prosthetic arms, for people to live their lives, and that technology is available to do that by describing neurons, that's fabulous. On the other hand, I'm also a recovering alcoholic, and I'm here to testify. We don't know. At this point, the language of AA is far superior to the language of psychotropic drugs. That may change. The question is, what's more useful?
Yes, that's very good. May I ask how you first described yourself? Did you say you were a recovering philosopher?
He did, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
He did.
Well, let me quote Samuel Johnson, the great lexicographer in Boswell's biography. He had a friend who said, I thought to go into philosophy, but cheerfulness kept breaking in. Let me answer your question to some degree. You have a very good point. And the problem is this, that I think I would welcome Christoph on this as well, and that is that animals have what I would call primary consciousness. They do not have language. They have communication, but they don't have a true language with syntax that we do. We can spin up anything with our language, right? Fantasies, psychotic intervals, AA meetings, whatever you wish. And the problem there is, of course, that language is powerful both for its clarity but also for its ambiguity. And so we can make up a lot of things and remove ourselves from the real drive of the real world to some degree by the fantasies of language. Now, underneath it all, I think Christoph would agree, are the jitterings of the neurons. But, of course, it's silly to say you're not going to talk in terms of linguistic formulations, and certainly it is the case that we don't fully understand how the brain gives rise to human language. That's a wonderful problem in itself. So one has to be pragmatic about this.
Christoph, you want to add anything?
No, Jerry said it all.
Well, I want to ask about whether unconsciousness or the subconscious, as some psychologists have called it, is that the opposite of consciousness?
Yeah, in some
or is it an aspect of consciousness?
All the sets of processes in the brain that do not give rise to consciousness. So, in fact, probably most of the activity of the brain is not associated with any form of consciousness.
Right.
Most of the things you do unconscious. Most of the biases are unconscious, and you don't even know about them. And you can deny them, but they're still there.
So when we're driving without even thinking about it, are we working on a conscious or an unconscious level?
For the most part, that's a highly trained activity, and you can do it unconscious. It's amazing if you live in Southern California, if you see what people can do while they're driving.
Yeah, I dare say I agree. The issue is something like this. There are parts of the brain which are not responsible for consciousness, but which may contribute. They are subcortical parts, like, for example, there's a part of your brain called the hippocampus, which is responsible for long-term memory, and the removal of which leaves you in a predicament in which you can't convert short-term memory into long. And certainly that plays on consciousness, but it's not in itself essential. The persons who've had it removed because of threats of epilepsy can still be conscious. So there are all of these parts integrated in the... In fact, the word integrated is the word I'd like to emphasize. It is quite clear that, for example, if Glenn Gould, even that great genius, were practicing a particular sonata or even better, a concerto, he may play the phrases slowly in his practice. But finally, they go down into the non-conscious parts of the brain and automatic motor activity. If he were recording a concerto with Lenny Bernstein and Lenny proceeded to slow down without warning, then his consciousness would come in just as a lookout statement would get you away from the motor act when you're driving. So it's both. And in fact, it's a very good thing that most of our activity is not conscious.
We tend to emphasize consciousness, but there are so many things. For example, your immune system is a very complicated example of a system that learns, as Jerry has shown. That was his Nobel Prize work, but it's yet totally unconscious. It does its work totally in the absence of any conscious sensation. In your gut, there are 100 million neurons called the enteric nervous system. Again, it does its work silent. It does its, you know, whatever it does down there. In fact, you don't want to know about it, and it works without consciousness.
Yep. And sometimes when people talk of gut feeling, it's not so wrong. The idea of an intuitive judgment, which isn't made really with any basis of logic, sometimes it turns out to be correct.
Are there diseases or conditions besides the condition of a coma which have provided a window into consciousness?
Yeah, usually it's less diseases. It's more the things that sort of Oliver Sacks studies. For instance, his famous short story, The Man Who Took His Wife for a Hat, tells us there's a discrete part of the brain in cerebral cortex, the part that Jerry mentioned. And if you lose that, you lose a very specific aspect of consciousness. In this case, you do not consciously see a face anymore. You see the eyes, you see the nose, you see the ears, but you do not see a face consciously. Why? Well, because the stroke or the gunshot or whatever has destroyed the nerve cells that are responsible for seeing the face.
Yeah, that's a very good point he's making, Christoph. The fact is that person can take a test, however, and even though he's not conscious of his wife's hat and of his wife as compared to the hat, under the test, unconsciously, he can give the right answer. He's simply not capable. And it's a very good thing that Christoph pointed this out, because it's more this idea of neuropsychology when parts of the brain are destroyed. For example, one part of your brain called the parietal cortex, if it has a stroke which destroys it on the right side of your brain, and maybe the stroke extends a little, you can have a disease or syndrome called anosognosia, in which you don't even know that you're paralyzed on the left side. And there's a rather famous story of professor in Milan, who's an expert in this subject, who came up to a patient who had anosognosia, who had what they call hemineglect. He couldn't pay any attention to the left side of the world, and he said, "Here, Mr. X, here are two cubes. Do with your left hand what I'm doing with my left hand." The patient said, "Sure, there it is, doc." And the doctor said, "No, you didn't." And the patient said, "Sure, I did." So he moved the patient's hand into his right visual field and said, "Whose hand is this?" And the patient said, "Yours." He said, "Mr. X, I can't have three hands." And the patient said, "Doc, it stands to reason. If you have three arms, you have to have three hands."
We're going to have to leave it there. I thank you both so much for being with us on today's Please Explain, Gerald Edelman, Nobel laureate, director of the Neurosciences Institute in La Jolla, California, author of many books, including Wider Than the Sky, The Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness. Also, Christoph Koff, professor of biology and engineering at the California Institute of Technology in Southern California, author of, among others, The Quest for Consciousness, A Neurobiological Approach. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Goodbye, Christoph. Good to hear your voice.